Welcome to Preheated, kitchen wisdom and friendly chat from two friends who love to bake. I'm Andrea Ballard.
And I'm Stefan Cohn.
Each week, we celebrate the successes, failures, learning, and laughs that go hand in hand with baking for those we love. On today's Super Stuff Show, we're kicking off our month of holiday baking with a classic gift from your kitchen, fudge. It's not as scary as it may seem. We're also going to check in on our fruitcake, finally crack our eggnog, learn a new baking term, talk you through calibrating your oven, not sexy, but crucial, and do a rundown of magazine recipes on newsstands now. So pour yourself a cup of coffee or some nog and get ready for some sweet talk. Stefan, have you looked at our preheated group on Facebook today?
Andrea, I have, and I am beside myself with excitement.
I assume you saw Vicky's post. So one of our listeners named Vicky, she's our first listener who has posted pictures from one of our bake-alongs. So Vicky made the cranberry cake that we cooked up a couple of episodes ago, and she posted a picture of it. I thought it turned out quite nicely.
It was lovely. And Vicky had some just really heartfelt and wonderful things to say. Vicky, we love you. You're in Louisville, Kentucky. Thank you so much. Vicky had some great ideas for adding walnuts to the cranberry topping, which sounds delicious. I'm a huge walnut fan myself.
I thought about adding walnut. I thought about adding a nut as well. I didn't do it, but I thought with that caramely topping, I had that same thought.
And it looks like it turned out wonderfully and that her family enjoyed it at Thanksgiving time. So thank you, Vicky. And reminder to all of our listeners, we would love to see your handiwork in the kitchen. So post those pictures and keep us posted.
Yes, please. And speaking of Thanksgiving desserts, I'm dying to hear what your family and friends thought about the controversial Tom Douglas purchased pecan pie. No, pumpkin, right?
Pumpkin gingerbread. Yeah. Mm. So I call it as I see it, Andrea. And this was a delicious pie. I cannot tell a lie. It really was. It was so good. It was just really classy. There were several touches I really appreciated. The first being that it was made in a real pie pan. It was not a disposable aluminum pan. We had to return it and pay a deposit, but, you know, still, classy touch there. It was beautifully created, you know, lovely crimping, had some nice kind of fall leaves of pie crust on the top. And it was the gingerbread. It wasn't a gingerbread crust. That's what I had gone into this thinking. Mm-hmm. It was a regular pie crust, but then a gingerbread layer on the bottom. And then the pumpkin filling on top. And so the gingerbread layer was kind of that chewy gingerbread. But then the pumpkin layer, my husband and I disagreed on the texture. And one of our Facebook friends had said something about a pumpkin chiffon pie.
Right.
Right, which incorporates egg whites into the pumpkin mix. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's what this layer is. Because it was, to me, it was very light in comparison then to that kind of dense and fudgy gingerbread layer. But my husband thought it was more like a peanut butter pie filling.
Oh,
so
interesting.
That's very different. Definitely as the pie, you know, my first slice and then my second slice the next day with leftovers. I did think that texture had changed a little bit. But, you know, would I buy this pie in a restaurant? Yes. Would I buy it again? Yes. But at the end of the day, it wasn't my pumpkin pie. And so I'm still craving my pumpkin pie.
Yeah.
And I think I'll just have to make that up, you know, here soon in the holiday season.
Right.
So yes, it was delicious. It saved us some work and was a, you know, obviously fun conversation piece, but it's not going to preclude me from making my pumpkin pie.
No.
So
there's something to be said for, especially at Thanksgiving, having certain family recipes that are traditional and they might not be technically the best, but they're what you're looking forward to and what you want. So
exactly. And you made kind of a new dessert this holiday season. So tell us about your semifreddo.
Okay. So we did Italian theme. So I, you know, went on the internet and searched for Italian desserts. And one thing that kept popping up was a semifreddo, which is a lighter ice cream. And so I found a recipe for pumpkin semifreddo, and I made it. It was layered with a gingerbread crumb crust as well. So you have the gingerbread crumb crust on the bottom, a layer of the pumpkin semifreddo, a layer of the gingerbread crumb crust, a layer of the pumpkin semifreddo, and then more crumb crust on top, and then some whipped cream.
Oh,
it was good. It was definitely
sounds like it.
Yeah, it was definitely good. And I've had people over since then who've had some, you know, even after Thanksgiving, and they liked it. It wasn't my favorite pie or my favorite dessert that day. And I don't know. I love pumpkin and I love ice cream and I love gingerbread. So right. I don't know why it wasn't my favorite. My favorite that day, I made a Marionberry pie, and
yes,
it was so good. I just thought it was perfect. I also made pecan bars because my husband has told me that he's not really a big pecan pie fan. I know, which is, it's disappointing, but I rallied and
you can live with it.
I can live with
he
it.
He really loves peanut butter, right? So it's not the nut necessarily. It's just something else about the pie.
You know what he's complained about pecan pie is that it's just like so sweet it hurts his teeth. And
right.
I, you know, I'm like, yes, that's the point.
Yeah.
But I get it. He didn't like it. So the pecan bar recipe that I found had a shortbread crust, and it basically in my mind was kind of like taking a pecan pie and taking out that gooey middle layer. So it had the shortbread crust and then it had the pecan topping, but there wasn't a lot of gooiness and sticky. There was some honey and there were some molasses, but there wasn't this huge amount of syrup, basically.
Okay.
And so he loved those. They were very rich. I cut them into really small squares. And in fact, we ended up freezing them and pulling them out a couple of times after Thanksgiving, and they held up really well. So I highly recommend that if you want sort of a pie-like experience, but you want something that is a little bit more portable and easier to eat in small pieces, to go with the pecan bar instead.
That sounds wonderful. Ina Garten has a pecan bar that I've made in the past, and it's the same. You can just have a tiny bite of it, and I really like that. Mm-hmm. And I like anything you can freeze and then bring back out again. So
yeah, and it's still just as good. So
yum.
All right.
Well, Andrea, also in the interest of full disclosure, we should tell our listeners that as we speak today, we are sipping on our eggnog.
That's right. I have a little dollop of it in my coffee.
Yes, we have just a very petite portion because we will not share what time in the morning we're recording this today. So let's talk about that as we're just kind of sipping throughout the episode. We hope that folks have nogged along with us and are now reaping the rewards of that experiment. This eggnog is so creamy. That's the overwhelming kind of sensation that floods through me as I take a sip. It's so delightful. It's so nothing like anything you could buy in the store. It's just worth it, every bit of it, and the waiting and the aging and all of that. So
yeah.
And in coffee, it must be really good too.
Well, it is really good in coffee. I made two batches. So I pulled one batch out on the evening of Thanksgiving. And I have to say, I think this eggnog should be treated as a dessert.
Yeah.
It's definitely not something – it's so rich. I mean,
it is.
You can't – I don't think you could eat like a huge slice of pie and a big glass of this eggnog.
Oh, no. I mean, you could.
Well, one could, yes. But it's not advisable. But with, for example, maybe 2 to 3 ounce glass of this, I poured it in kind of the smaller size glasses, like a smaller highball type glass, and serve it with maybe those small pecan bars. And then I thought it was really nice. I forgot to grate the nutmeg on top, so I'm annoyed at myself that I forgot that. I feel like that's a crucial piece.
So
I have my second batch still, so I have a chance to redeem myself there.
Yeah. Right. And you know, some of the comments on our Facebook page, we were talking with folks about the fact that this does not make, you know, gallons and gallons of eggnog. And that's really to your point that, you know, I think the original recipe says it serves 3 to 4, but you're really only serving, you know, a finger of this, you know, or a couple inches in the glass. So it's really all you need. And then put up another batch because it's so delicious. So All right, so if you hear us, you know, slurping and swallowing during the during the episode, it's our eggnog. And we're going to go on to our next boozy treat, which was the fruitcake. Yes. How did that turn out for you, Andrea?
Well, it turned out really amazing, I think. Yay! I had to make quite a few modifications. So my first modification, I went to the store to get apricot nectar, which I didn't have on hand. And I found this sort of specialty fruit juice section at my grocery store. And it was a big grocery store. And they had maybe 10 different kinds of fruit nectars. So they had a strawberry nectar and guava nectar and strawberry guava nectar. And there was no apricot nectar.
Was it sold out or just wasn't there?
It just wasn't there. I mean, I read the tags on the shelf as well, and there was no spot for apricot nectar. So I went with mango nectar. I felt like that was close enough and sort of
tropical.
A bit tropical, kind of ended up going with the tropical theme.
Right.
So I did also buy some dried mango to go into the cake because I felt like that would, you know, sort of tie in with the nectar.
Yeah.
I also decided not to spend, you know, $30 on apricot brandy for the whopping, whatever, 2 tablespoons I needed. So I just went with regular old brandy. And I had some dried peaches and dried pineapple left over. And so I also added those to my fruitcake. So quite a few modifications, but overall, I think, you know, I stuck to the spirit of the recipe and I wrapped it in cheesecloth and I, you know, poured my apricot or my mango nectar on it every couple of days. And I tried it for the first time on Tuesday and I just thought it was fabulous. It was moist. It was flavorful. It you could taste the nuts. The nuts and the dried fruit still had some crunch and some bite to them, which
I
liked.
Yes.
I was a little worried about it kind of being mushy, but it wasn't that way at all.
So did you not use the pears and apricots at all, or did you use them in addition to that other fruit you were talking about?
In addition to. Yeah.
Okay.
I also did the pears and the apricots.
Okay. And I also love that it's a really pretty cake when you slice it.
It is.
Because it's that blonde cake, and then it has just kind of like little jewels of the orangey apricot and the kind of caramel-colored pears and then the nuts, and it's really beautiful. And I have no shame in telling everyone that I single-handedly have eaten about 75% of the cake myself. I'll just be like, I'm just gonna have a little slice. And then you know that happens. It's like with a pan of brownies or whatever, you look at it and you're like, how did all of this, where did it go? And you realize with horror it's gone into your body. But it is so good, and it really keeps very well for a while. And so, you know, we served some with Thanksgiving, but it's still going strong and not drying out. I haven't doused it again. The one thing I did want to ask you was what temperature you baked it at. Our recipe called for 350, and that seemed weird to me when I was baking it. So I put it down. But
I
ended up baking it a little bit longer. So I think that should be a modification.
Mm-hmm. I did too. Mainly because I had just baked my fruitcake with my neighbor, and his recipe was at a much lower temperature for 2 hours.
Yes.
And so I think I baked it at 325 instead of 350. And I still feel like, and if I post a picture, those who see the picture will see, my edges got a little crusty, I thought. I personally like crusty edges. Like, I will always fight for that end piece in any type of loaf bread.
Right.
So I was okay with that.
This was not a problem for you. Right.
Not for me, but I don't think, you know, that's necessarily what other people would want, so.
Readers, we hope you have either baked along with us or will do that this holiday season. And remember that we'll put a link to this. A link is already there on our website. And we would love to see your pictures up on Facebook, too, to let us know how you felt about this macadamia nut fruitcake.
Yes, you still have time. You can do the fruitcake. You can do the eggnog and still enjoy it for the holidays. So we'd love to see what you guys can do.
You bet. So, Andrea, we are now officially kicking off our holiday baking month.
Yes. Welcome, December.
Woohoo! We are here. And we're going to be talking about a variety of gifts from your kitchen. That's something that Andrea and I both really enjoy doing during the whole year, but, you know, especially at the holidays, that's a time when lots of people are gifting food items. So we thought we'd start with a classic holiday gift, which is fudge.
Fudge, yay!
Now, many people, like with the fruitcake, have this kind of scary, oh, I could never make fudge kind of reaction. And a really nice thing about the recipe that we have chosen to make is the name. Number one, it's called Happy People Fudge. So adorable.
It will make people happy. That's why it's called that.
Yes. It's also not a cooked fudge, which, and you know, Andrea and I were talking about what the term for this kind of fudge is. It's, you can make it in the microwave, you can make it on a double boiler, but you're not cooking the butter and using a candy thermometer and, you know, is it that softball stage? Is it, no. There's none of that. It is
that.
So easy. And there, you will be amazed, we hope, at the results. Also, there's no reason to put yourself through that when the results turn out this good.
That's what I think too. The reason I like this recipe so much, so I love to eat fudge. I had never tried to make it. And in fact, my experience with fudge was based entirely on those tourist fudge places where they...
Like the saltwater taffy places?
I don't know if they do saltwater taffy, but at least in New Orleans, they had a fudge place down in the Riverwalk. And the people would pour these enormous vats of fudge onto these marble tables. And then they would take like the big scrapers and they would be moving the fudge back and forth on the table. And they would also be singing as they did it.
There's nothing wrong with that. Sing if you want to make this fudge.
I just thought to myself, you know, if there's anything that spells production, like, yeah, you know, a singing fudge event, I just thought, well, that's clearly not for me. And then I started working at a law firm in Seattle, and one of the lovely, lovely ladies, her name is Donna Bishop, who worked in the Portland office, I learned that she was a fudge maker. And the way I learned it is one day the mailroom called me and they were like, Andrea, you've got a box. You've got to come open it. And I get into the mailroom and, you know, there's this horde of people standing around. And
they knew what it was.
They knew. You know, I didn't know. And so I go to open this box. Well, first of all, I almost, like, you know, dropped it because it was so heavy. And then I open it up and here are just these, you know, tiny chunks of the most beautiful, glossy, nut-filled chocolate fudge that I've ever seen. And people just dove into it. So Donna was well known for this, and everyone looked forward to her fudge every year. And she obviously, you know, had it perfected all the way from baking it to shipping it and, you know, cutting it up so that it was beautiful. And I found myself, whenever Donna's fudge was in the office, making multiple trips past the mailroom on those days because, you know, I just better check on something in the mailroom. And, oh, well, I'm here, I'll just grab a piece of fudge. So I teased Donna that my annual tradition for the longest time was every year I would email her at the beginning of December and say, oh, can I get your fudge recipe again? And, you know, finally I realized I needed to save it in a safe place.
Yes.
Because it was clear it was a keeper. So we will post the Happy People Fudge recipe on our website, and we would love for you guys to make it along with us. It does, the instructions use a microwave, but as you might know, I don't have a microwave, so I use a double boiler, and that works just fine as well, and it's still just super easy.
And it's a fast recipe. This would be a good one to try with kids.
Yes.
And it has just, you know, all the great ingredients. I've never made a fudge with condensed milk, sweetened condensed milk. That's kind of a key ingredient in this fudge, so I'm really interested as to what this does texture-wise and taste-wise, so...
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that. Don't do what I did one year, which was I wasn't paying attention in the grocery store and I accidentally bought evaporated milk instead of sweetened condensed milk.
Huge difference. Will not, big do difference. Not substitute. Will not work.
It will not set up. You will have a lovely bowl of chocolate sauce, but you could stir it all day long and it will never set.
And see, that's another difference because in a cooked fudge recipe that I've done in the past, you do use evaporated milk.
Okay.
You know, folks who may have that in their mind, like really read the ingredients and no substitutions here for the condensed milk.
Right. So. Right. Right.
Awesome.
So next week we will follow up on our fudge adventures. We'd love to see your pictures or any of your comments about fudge on our Facebook group, Preheated. And now we're going to talk about a new baking-related vocabulary word.
Oh, so exciting.
So step with me into the language lab. When I got to the end of the eggnog recipe, I read this sentence. When ready to serve, mix the eggnog with a hand mixer and serve it in a chilled coupe.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, well, that's a car.
And we do not advocate drunk driving. Absolutely not. No.
And I'm thinking, you know, do they mean like a little miniature car version?
Or, that would be cute, you know, too.
What on earth is this? So, you know, I went online and searched for this. First of all, I found out I was pronouncing it incorrectly. So it is coupé.
Oh.
It comes from the French. And there were the first two definitions. So number one was a car with a fixed roof and two doors.
Okay.
And number two was a four-wheeled enclosed carriage for two passengers and a driver. And I thought, okay, well, I'm not crazy. That is what a coupé is. But then there was a tiny little link that said more definitions. And when I clicked on it, it said a shallow glass or glass dish, typically with a stem in which desserts or champagne are served.
Yes.
So you already knew this. You had heard of this word.
The champagne glasses that my mom had growing up were that coupe style.
Okay.
And they're actually harder to find now. I think they've kind of attained some kind of, you know, nostalgic renaissance. And so I've been on the hunt for the coupe champagne glasses, like a vintage kind. So,
and I think we called this a sherbet dish in my house growing up.
I mean, it's really the very similar, if not the same, design, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think so. So the other interesting thing, if you look that word up on the internet, they have now with words a geographic timeline that shows the usage of the word and in terms of the number of instances in the written word.
Cool.
And so in the 1800s, it wasn't used at all. And then, you know, you see it sort of creeping up. And 1940s appeared to be the height of the coupe. That's so...
Well, we're bringing it back. So.
We're bringing it back, sister.
Coupe. I love it. Well, thank you, Andrea. This will be an ongoing segment. Whenever we run across a word that we are a little unfamiliar with, we'll go ahead and try to better ourselves and our vocabulary. So
there we go.
Awesome. All right. Well, we are going to tackle something that, shockingly, neither one of us has really done before. And so we thought it was really crucial, and it's calibrating your oven. So if your oven is brand new right out of the box, you know, perhaps you've got the perfect temp. When it's 375, it's truly 375. But for many of us, that's actually not the case. And as, you know, holiday baking is really revving up, you're going to have better success, obviously, if your oven isn't running hot or cold. So we thought we would explain briefly how you go about checking if your oven is really at the heat it says it is and that you want it to be.
Yes.
And so the first thing you need to do is just get a little metal oven thermometer, and they're very inexpensive. You could get them on Amazon or like at your hardware store, and you're going to set it to 350, let it heat up, put it in there, and take a check after about 20 minutes. Seems to be kind of the rationale. Mm-hmm. And there you go. Andrea, were you surprised by the level of controversy in the oven calibrating world as I was?
It was a little bit shocking.
It was, yes.
I didn't realize there were such strongly held opinions about calibration. You know, one thing I will add to what Stefan just shared is make sure when you put that portable thermometer in that you put it in the dead center of your oven.
Good
because
point. Yep.
As I discovered when I was reading, ovens can have hot spots. I know I don't have this problem because I have previously cooked in ovens where I did have this problem. And, you know, so I would find that if I baked a sheet of cookies, for example, the two on the back row and the left would always cook faster and brown more than the ones in the front row.
Yep.
So when you're going for the calibration, shoot for the center. If you want to then move it around and see if you have some hot spots in your oven, go ahead. Now, personally, I don't know what you'd do if you found that you did have those hot spots other than maybe try and avoid them
just
or at least rotate your pants.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, just a little sidebar, that reminds me of something I learned on the Martha Stewart Living Show pretty long time ago, but how to check for hot spots is just to put a cookie sheet filled with white bread, just like Wonder Bread, and then, you know, stick it in there and you're going to see how it toasts, and there's going to be some that are still really, really under toasted where you might have some that are burnt. And then again, you'll just, you'll know kind of where those spots are occurring in your oven. So,
Interesting. Well, my experience with calibration came up about 3 years ago because we moved into a new house and it didn't have an oven. So we had to buy an oven. And so I got an oven. I got a gas cooktop, but I got an electric oven because I knew that electric for me is more reliable when it comes to baking than gas. And I started using this new oven, and I was used to being able to take a completely cold oven and set it to 350 and have it ready to go and be at 350 in, you know, at the most, maybe 15 minutes.
Okay.
And in this new oven, I was noticing it would take 20 minutes, sometimes 25 minutes, sometimes 30 minutes.
Well, this is a long time.
That's what I thought. And so I called out my handy dandy repairman, and he came out, Fred, and Fred's been doing oven repair for 37 years, so I trust his opinion. And he said, you know what, Andrea, this is not a defect. This is how ovens are meant to work now. He said, I would be very suspicious of an oven that got to 350 in 10 minutes.
Really?
And he said that even if your oven did get to 350, let's say in 15 minutes or 20 minutes, he felt like you should always preheat your oven for at least 30 minutes before you put anything into it that involves baking.
Oh.
Because, you know, that timer that goes off or dings when you hit your 350 just means that, you know, in one spot in the oven, it's now measured 350.
Oh.
But it's not a consistent, reliable, you know, that sort of steady temperature. So his routine was when he got home from work every night, he said he literally walked in the door, put down his keys, walked over the oven, and set the oven to preheat to 350, even if he had no idea what he was making for dinner that night. So he said, you know, worst case scenario, you ended up doing something on the stove and you turned your oven off because you had it on when you didn't need to. But he just felt like everything worked better in an oven that had been preheated for a long time. And shortly after I had that talk with him, and I was letting my oven preheat for longer and having pretty good results, I read another interview with a baker, and I can't remember who he was, but someone was asking him, you know, how do you, because he baked fresh bread every day for his family. They were like, how do you do that? You know, do you get up at the crack of dawn to get your oven going?
Right.
And he said, no, you know, I have a delay feature on my oven. So when I go to bed at night, I set it to turn on and I can time it like in 8 hours, in 10 hours, in 12 hours.
Oh.
And he said, so basically I turn my oven on before I ever even get up. And so I went to bed that night. I was so excited. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do that. And that way I'm going to wake up and my oven's going to be preheated and I can just pop my cinnamon rolls
right.
or whatever
yeah,
into
you're
it.
You're ready to go.
Unfortunately, with my oven, when you hit that delay point and the oven turns on, it starts beeping to let you know.
Oh, no. So then it was going to beep at you all night?
Like, well, not all night, but in my case, I had set it, you know, like, let's say I went to bed at 10 and I had set it to turn on in 8 hours at 6 a.m. So at 6 a.m., all of a sudden we're hearing beep.
Oh, got it.
Beep.
Like when it starts working, it's letting you know.
It's letting you know, which now that I think about it, that's probably a good safety feature.
Yes, that is. Yes. Yeah, so your child hasn't crawled into the oven or something.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But in terms of, you know, you're trying to sleep and now your oven's beeping continually, that didn't work out too well for me.
That would not be restful. No. Well, great tip from Fred there. And we hope that that's helped a little bit. If you want more information on calibrating your oven, there's a wealth of information out there. And some people do kind of an average of a few tests, but it's good to know. And then you can also have a repairman or check your manual. If your oven is off by, you know, a significant amount, 50 degrees or so, there is a way to reset that. And and you can do that too. So wonderful. Well, we hope that leads to just nothing but baking success.
Yes.
All right, we're going to quickly introduce a new segment that I'm thrilled to introduce, and it's called The Magazine Maven, and that is me. I am a huge, huge magazine fan. I've been reading quote-unquote women's magazines since I was about 9 years old. I would take my mom's family circles and women's days and Better Homes and Gardens, and that's really also where my love of reading recipes and baking and cooking came from too. So in this short episode, I'm going to talk about some magazines that are currently on the newsstands, and if you don't subscribe to two dozen magazines like I do, then you can just spend your money wisely and maybe pick up some of these that I think are worth it. And I'm going to start with Good Housekeeping this month, the December issue. It's got a gorgeous cookie wreath on the cover. Really nice. Mm. Some nice, more of your classic type cookies. They do kind of a popular thing, which is to make one dough, but then variations on how you can use that dough. So if time is tight or you're just looking to make one dough, that's a nice place to start. But Andrea, this also, the thing that I really enjoyed in this issue was just a small little sidebar, and it said, do you have leftover eggnog? Here's what you can do. You can freeze leftovers like in an ice cube tray and then pop it into a glass of rum or a cup of coffee down the road. So although I wouldn't recommend this with our eggnog, if you do buy a carton of eggnog for drinking or for other recipes, pasteurized, try that. So that's a good way to reduce waste and have some yummy beverages.
I've never had leftover eggnog. Right. I feel that it's part of my duty to make certain that
Let's be honest, this may not be a problem for you, but if it is. the second one is the December issue of Family Circle, and they had a lot of great cookies also. But the one recipe that really stood out to me in this magazine was, are you ready? The Jumbo Nutella Cinnamon Rolls. So this probably has Christmas morning written all over it for my family. Nutella is a way of life for my son, and my daughter loves cinnamon rolls. This is a make-ahead recipe. I love that. So you could get up, hit preheat on your oven, and then pop in your pan of rolls that have been in the fridge overnight. So I loved that. But the one, if you're only going to buy one magazine, Andrea, you're not going to be surprised by this recommendation.
Probably not.
It is the special double issue, the December issue of Southern Living. This month is gorgeous. I didn't know Southern Living. I knew Southern Living magazine, but I had never read it until I really met you, and you subscribed to it and had started passing me some issues. And Southern Living is really known for its recipes and especially its cakes. And the cakes in this issue are out of this world.
Did you see the cake on the cover?
Yes, and it's a coconut cake. So I know we'd had some discussion with Facebook fans about that. Yes, the name of it is unreal. It's coconut cake with rum filling and coconut ermine frosting. I mean, correct me, but isn't ermine like a fur? Like it's a small, like you'd make like a mink out of it? It is gorgeous. And
I'm going to try and make it. I've got an event coming up weekend after next. I'm going to try and make it. I've had great success from Southern Living recipes, and I just think they're beautiful. They're a little bit different than what people typically make up here in the Pacific Northwest, so I think that's kind of fun too. You know, not like, for example, red velvet cake is anything shocking, but you know, a lot of people up here, I'll make a red velvet cake and they won't know red velvet cake, whereas in the South, you know, I think it's much more common. So,
well, that brings up a good point, because the recipe that I think I'm going to try is the red velvet cheesecake vanilla cake with cream cheese frosting. So this is this is a layer of red velvet cheesecake, then a layer of vanilla cake, then another layer of red velvet cheesecake, all enrobed in cream cheese frosting. And that, it just is gorgeous.
It's going to be beautiful.
So if you only buy one magazine, this one is chock full of cookies. They have a great cookie section. The cakes are beautiful. And then just some nice holiday entertaining as well.
Yes. Strong recommend. Two thumbs up on the Southern Living December issue for sure.
Yes, and it's a nice double issue. It's really thick, so good job. Yes. Good job. Well, Andrea, the timer's buzzed, and we've got to get to the dishes. Join us next week as we each share one of our favorite holiday cookies. We'll also talk about some cute and clever ways to package all of your homemade goodies, and we're welcoming our very first preheated guest, Anne Lundholm from Stick of Butter Studios.
Woohoo!
Our awesome theme music is by Anne-Marie Russell, featuring the talented Nathan Eklund on trumpet. You can find Anne-Marie's music on Amazon and iTunes or at annemarierussell.com. And remember, you can find us and our featured recipes on our website, preheatedpodcast.com, on Facebook and Pinterest, and you can download us on iTunes, where we'd love it if you subscribe to the show and gave us a 5-star rating, both of which will help others find us. And a special, special thank you and shout out to Nomi Knows, who gave us a 5-star review on iTunes with some kind and delightful comments. She says, even though she hates baking, she loves us. Aw, thank you, Nomi Knows.
Thank you, Nomi Knows.
So until next time, thanks for listening and sweet dreams. Preheated is written, performed, and edited by Andrea Ballard and Stefan Cohn in association with 24th Floor Productions.